Hi, Kate O'Toole here. Welcome to the guest room at ABC Local Online. I hope you enjoy this download. And don't forget, you can hear the guest room live each weekday from 11 a.m. on 105.7 ABC Darwin and 783 ABC Alice Springs.
We used to sit around the campfire.
And I was given a job as an assistant in the underpants section.
Wasn't so much a surprise when it happened, but it was most certainly a shock. I don't look back at it as a particularly bad part of my life.
I just felt there was something there.
The guest room.
This was the identity that we had seen on screen.
At that particular point of that era, heroin was a major epidemic within the music industry.
With Kate O'Toole on ABC Local Radio across the territory.
Brings tears to my eyes.
And today in the guest room, we're going to delve into some of the more tragic chapters of Australian history. My guest today has been responsible for alerting more people to the Australian frontier conflict than perhaps anyone else. Professor Henry Reynolds has documented the violent conflict between settler Australians and Indigenous Australians in 20 books and countless articles. He's best known for his books Why Weren't We Told? And The Other Side of the Frontier. But in more recent times, Henry's also written about the history of Australia's north and the Anzac legend. Henry Reynolds is in the Territory this week for the Wordstorm Festival and will be giving a free lecture at the NT Library at 12:15, just after this program. His take on Australian history is fascinating. It's powerful and at times controversial. I'm looking forward to delving into his ideas and his take on the Australian story that we tell about ourselves. Henry Reynolds will join me after his first musical selection. This is Van Diemen's Land by the Bushwhackers.
Three friends and I went out one night in the noble Squire's Park. We were hoping we might get some game. The night been proven dark, but by the Squire.
Chosen for you today by historian Professor Henry Reynolds, who's an author of 20 books and who's right here in the Territory for Wordstorm. Welcome to the guest room.
It's a pleasure.
So tell me a little bit about that song, if you could. Why did you pick that one?
That's a song about exile of the convicts. It's about Tasmania, that used to be called Van Diemen's Land. And it's a reminder to me and to anyone else who knows the background that 75,000 people, men and women, were exiled to Tasmania as convicts and became the foundation for that state's population. And when I was growing up, it was a shameful thing to acknowledge convict ancestry, but now it's apparent to us that 75% of Tasmanians are descended from convicts. And at last, after all this time, people are now proud rather than ashamed of their convict ancestors.
And do you have convict ancestors?
No, I feel very much out of it. My partner has discovered two convicts, which is not as many as many people have, but I don't have any at all, so I feel a little bit out of it.
You could borrow one of hers.
I could, yes.
You could share that, I'm sure. So you mentioned growing up in Tasmania. What do you remember about your childhood there, aside from the potential shame of potentially being related to convicts?
Well, I suppose one of the obvious things is that you are surrounded by the past. And my father was an amateur historian, but knew the history of Tasmania very well, as many, many people did. But you were surrounded by the buildings and the other sort of remnants of the old colonial period. So the past lived in Tasmania in a way that didn't exist in many other parts of Australia.
Is there a particular feature of your childhood that had the tangible history attached to it?
Well, I suppose one of the things I remember was at a school holiday going to Port Arthur, long before it became a great tourist attraction. And so you became very, very aware that there was another era, another sort of type of society that existed before the current present society that I was growing up in. So in Tasmania.
How old would you have been?
Well, I was about 10. And so Tasmanians had the habit of looking back as well as looking forward, whereas, you know, Queenslanders, for instance, always talk about the future. Tasmanians often thought about the past.
You're listening to The Guest Room. Professor Henry Reynolds is here with you today. Looking to the past as a Tasmanian, what sort of history were you raised on, though?
Well, we did learn a lot about, the convict system. We didn't learn a great deal about the tragedy of the Tasmanian Aborigines, although we learnt more, I think, than people on mainland Australia. It continued to be a story that was told, and we all learnt about Truganini, you know, supposedly the last of the Aborigines. And I think the story was that all that was behind us, but we remembered it.
And did you connect with that story as a...
Well,
kid?
To the extent that everyone did, and it was something that was not really discussed. I mean, we had this people knew that there were people known as half-castes who lived on the Bass Strait Islands, but they were a long way away and very remote. And so we didn't know much about the fact that there were people who continued to identify as Aborigines. I never met any of them in growing up.
You're widely known for your research and your work on the frontier conflict between Aboriginal and settler societies. I'm just wondering, when did that research journey start for you?
Well, that was entirely a product of going to North Queensland, to Townsville, in my mid-20s for a job at the new university college, and discovering an utterly different sort of Australia. And that was an Australia in which one met Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders every day of the week. You couldn't not be aware of the relations. I mean, race relations weren't something you read about in books. They were events that confronted you every day if you were anywhere near the centre of the town. And so I had to basically reorient my understanding of Australian history as I came to look at Australia, if you like, from the north down rather than from the south up.
How interesting that you went to this place where you said people only seem to look forward in order to really start this journey of yours reflecting back.
Well, people did not want to talk about the past. They did not want to talk about relations with Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. This was as taboo in Queensland as the convicts had been in Tasmania. But in a way, it was much more edgy and much more immediate because you saw in those periods, you know, this was in the 1960s when, for the first time, Aborigines and Islanders began to move into the towns in significant numbers. And there was a lot of violence. I mean, you saw fights in the street, black-white fights, every second time you went into town. So you couldn't ignore the reality of this or the violence in the present, which intimated that there was even greater violence in the past.
How did you begin, and what sorts of stories first came to you about the history of that frontier conflict?
Well, my partner Margaret, who went on to become a Labor senator from Queensland, was an activist, and she became involved very, very early in organisations, particularly with Bobby Sykes, who went on also to become a great activist. And so I became aware every day. I mean, people would come to our house with their problems. You know, with they had no money, they had no food, their children had been taken away from them. And Margaret became a de facto social worker and soon after this started a kindergarten for Aboriginal and Islander children. So in a way it was she that thrust me into the present day, and I then went back and started reading the records to understand the past.
And what sorts of records were you getting your hands on at that stage?
Well, there was had there been books about this question, I may not have set out myself to write the books I did. But there were no books, so I had to start reading the records, and the records included you know, the parliamentary papers of the Queensland Parliament, but also the newspapers, the 19th century newspapers. And in those records, the violence was inescapable. I mean, it poured out of the records. People talked about it. They talked about it incessantly in the newspapers. They had letters and debates. They talked about it in Parliament. So one couldn't avoid. I mean, you didn't have to go looking for it. The material found you.
Is there one particular piece of the puzzle, a diary entry or a newspaper article that stands out to you as being the most significant for its vividness or for its importance in this search for you?
Well, there were newspaper articles in I suppose the first newspaper I read was called the Port Denison Times, the newspaper from Bowen in North Queensland. And there were letters there where people simply said, we know the foundations of our town were cemented in blood. You know, we shot our way into the country. And no one disputed these letters. They might have said, oh, it's not polite to talk about it. But no one denied that this was the fact.
And how, as an historian, how do you then extrapolate to build a picture of what happened from these little fragments?
Ah, well, you do a great deal of reading. I mean, I spent many, many years. I mean, my first major book, The Other Side of the Frontier, was the end product of 10 years of research, in which I spent a great deal of time in Brisbane, in the archives, in the parliamentary library, reading the newspapers, and I went and around other parts of Australia, and I did an enormous amount of research. And it was only then that I felt confident that I could tell the story. But the story, I mean, you can only use in a book like that perhaps 1/10 or 1/20 of the material that you gathered.
And when you put it together and in that format, you came up with a story about Australia and an Australian history that a lot of people didn't want to hear.
No, that's absolutely...
Or wanted to deny.
You see, when I started teaching Australian history in Townsville, I was given the textbook that was set from Brisbane, because we were still dependent on Brisbane, and it was the most widely used history book used in universities and senior schools. And in many ways, it was a very good book. But it didn't mention the Aborigines once. Not once. They weren't even in the index. There was no entry in the index about Aborigines. In other words, up until then, they had virtually been written out of Australian history. Now, you can understand that if you were living in Melbourne or Sydney, but you couldn't see Australian history that way if you lived in Townsville or Darwin or Broome.
So what was the crux of the history wars then, and at what point were you thrust in the middle of that?
Well, that came quite a long time. That came 10 years after I'd written my first books. It took quite some time for what I was saying to begin to register. Now, one of the real breakthroughs, I think, where people began to take this all seriously was when my book, The Law of the Land, in a way looked forward to the Mabo judgment. And it was quite clear that the things I was saying were beginning to have an impact, and in particular were having an impact in the High Court. And that's when people began to take these things seriously. I mean, before that, they could dismiss this as, you know, this young radical from up there in Townsville, what does it matter what he thinks? But gradually, I think, the ideas became generally accepted. And then I think it was seen necessary to try and attack the things I'd been saying.
Is the history wars part of a debate that publicises the issue and therefore is a positive thing, or is it something that is offensive as an historian who's gathered all this information?
Well, it was unpleasant at the time, and it was offensive when, you know, I was called in public and in print a liar. Therefore, this was distressing. But by and large, it opened up the subject to intense debate. These issues are still being discussed in schools around Australia, and it provoked a lot more research that may not have happened had this history war controversy not erupted. So overall, I think it was probably a good thing. I think Australia doesn't have enough controversy about its history. I mean, compared, for instance, to the United States.
And has this dialogue changed since the apology, for example?
Well, I think reconciliation and the apology has had the tendency for people to think that that's all been put behind us. You know, that, yes, we understand that now, we've said sorry, let's move on. And I can understand that. But from my point of view, I think in a way we have simply put it aside for the moment, and these issues will re-emerge because I think there is still unfinished business.
And is that how you see Aboriginal history being treated now by schools and by universities and by the general public, that idea that basically it's something that we've dealt with?
I think that's, I mean, it's hard to generalise about, you know, schools and universities across the country, but I think my feeling is that that is the general sense, that we have dealt with it and we can now move on. But as anyone living in North Australia, and Darwin in particular, would know, there are still very, very large and troubling issues which have not been resolved.
You're listening to The Guest Room right across the territory. Kate O'Toole with you, here with Professor Henry Reynolds, who's an historian and author of 20 books, predominantly focusing on the history of Aboriginal and settler relations. We've been talking a little bit about that. We will continue to after we hear from The Wild Colonial Boys. Why did you choose this one?
Well, it's a song about North Queensland, about going to North Queensland when it was very, very far away. Well, it still seemed very, very far away when I first went there, and a very different place to Tasmania.
Saddle boys, hoorah for Stockwood too. Hoorah for the baldy pony boys to carry me westward home. To carry me westward, pony boys, that's where the cattle stray. On the far back hoo and the flinders too, 1,000 mile away.
You're listening to The Guest Room across the territory. Kate Oates with you, with Henry Reynolds as well. Henry, you touched on your relationship with the legal processes in Australia, and that your writing was starting to have an effect on the High Court and reflect a new understanding of Australian history in the early 90s, particularly with Mabo. Now, Eddie Mabo was a friend of yours.
He was a very good friend of mine.
How did that happen?
Well, we just got to know, Margaret and I got to know Eddie and Netta, and they had children much the same age as we did. I mean, we had three and they had seven, but, you know, in the early years we had children of much the same age. And we were involved in the same sort of organisations, that is, you know, Aboriginal welfare organisations. Edie and I worked on collecting oral history, so we had a lot in common and we had a lot to talk about.
And it was a conversation that you had one time that proved to be hugely significant.
Well, yes, in retrospect, that is what happened. Eddie would talk a great deal about Murray Island, which was his home island, and about his land. And I knew that he hadn't been back on the island for 10 years and for quite a while wasn't allowed to go back. And I said to him once, but how do you know your land will still be there when you go back? And he said, oh, everyone knows it's Mabo land. You know, there's no question about that. And when I go back, it'll be waiting for me. And it was only then that I realised that he had absolutely no idea that he didn't have any legal title to that land. It was entirely a traditional, customary ownership. And he could have been turned off that land, which had been his for generations, and he knew something like 16 generations back. He could have been turned off at any time by the government without compensation. So I debated with myself and with a colleague whether I should tell him. And eventually I felt I had to, so I said to him, look, you do realise, do you, that you don't own your land at all? And he was just astounded. He knew me well enough to realise that what I was saying was true, but he was aghast. How could it be doubted that it was his land? Now, it was from that conversation and from a later one when I talked to him about going to the courts, because I knew that in America there had been court cases on these very issues, that was what led eventually to him taking up this cause to prove in the courts that he actually did own his land. And that was the genesis of the famous Mabo case.
And did you take any role in that case beyond that point?
No, because I wasn't a trained lawyer. I mean, by the early 80s, Eddie had met at a conference in Townsville some of the most significant lawyers who knew something about native title, and there weren't many in Australia at the time. So they took the cause up. But what I did was go away and do the research, the historical research, which resulted in a book called The Law of the Land, which, in a way, greatly assisted the arguments, showing the historical background to the extraordinary idea that Australia was a terra nullius, that is, that Indigenous people had no property rights.
And was that your intention in writing that book?
Well, it was really wanting to understand myself, to intellectually establish why it was that these decisions had been made. And I went into it with an open mind. I taught myself a great deal about the law. I sat in the practitioner's library at the High Court for months, going back into court cases and property law for hundreds of years, until I understood what had happened in Australia.
Which?
Well, when the British arrived, they didn't recognise that the Aborigines had any right to title. Now, that wasn't what they'd done in North America before 1788, and it wasn't what they did in New Guinea, in New Zealand later, nor in New Guinea, nor in Fiji. There was this anomalous situation where only the Aborigines were regarded as being unable to have land ownership. And this was particularly difficult for someone like Eddie, who, after all, the Murray Islanders were more Melanesian than Aboriginal. And they had garden plots, you know, marked out garden plots that they'd owned for centuries. So that in a way, the Mabo situation simply highlighted the anomalous situation, which the High Court did, of course, understand. It was anomalous and they changed the law.
Were you in court when that judgment was handed down?
No, I was in court in the last day of hearing when Eddie himself was there, but I wasn't able to be there when the judgment came down.
And where were you when you heard about it?
Well, I think, I mean, from recollection, I was in Townsville. It was probably a teaching week.
So it wasn't a huge moment when you heard?
It was. I mean, Eddie was always confident. A great many lawyers in Australia said, no, they can't do that. You know, it'd be overturning the law of 200 years. There's never been any recognition of native title in Australia. It can't be done. But I was much more confident because I had, as I say, I'd done the research and understood why it was anomalous and why Australia almost certainly had to re-enter the mainstream of the common law tradition on Indigenous rights.
And how did Eddie Mabo reflect on his achievement?
Well, of course he didn't, because he died prematurely. He was struck down with cancer of the spine and died at the beginning of that year, sort of 4 or 5 months before the judgment came down. So it was a great tragedy, because he would have exulted, but it would have confirmed his belief in his rights. But also, it's significant that Eddie was confident that the legal system would find in his favour, whereas many, many Indigenous people would say, don't be silly, they will never recognise our rights, whereas he always felt that justice would be done.
Did he see it as an achievement that was taken to the High Court, that it was discussed and that he felt confident in the result?
Oh, yes, it had been going on, you know, it had been through the courts for 10 years, back and forth between the, you know, Queensland and the High Court. I think he fully believed that his stand would be justified. And as did the other two. There were other two, Rice and Passy. And David Passy, who was an Anglican clergyman, was completely confident that God would find in their favour.
Did he see it, though, as something that would change the way it was for everyone?
Oh, he understood. He understood, yeah. Yes. He understood very well that these were very, very significant issues.
And how did you see the law of native title evolving up to now? Where are we up to?
Well, it's obviously, you know, there's an enormous amount of case law. Basically, there is still that important recognition that unless there is a clear extinguishment of Indigenous rights probably continue to exist. This was, in a way, strengthened by the Wick judgment about past releases. And many, many Aboriginal people all around Australia have had their right to property recognised. This doesn't mean there haven't been problems, it hasn't been long and tortuous, but nonetheless it is a vast improvement on what existed before 1992.
You're listening to The Guest Room right across the Territory. Professor Henry Reynolds is with me. He's an historian. He's the author of 20 books, most of them focusing on that history we've been talking about, the history of Aboriginal and settler relations, the history of that violent frontier conflict. Some of his books include The Other Side of the Frontier, Why Weren't We Told?, North of Capricorn, and What's Wrong with Anzac? Well, talk a little bit about the Anzac history in a moment. But first, you were struck by the divide between North Australia and South when you arrived in Townsville in the mid-60s. Is that what prompted this history of Northern Australia in particular, north of Capricorn?
It started when I had to teach Australian history to students who came from North Queensland, most of them from towns smaller than Townsville. Many of them had never been out of North Queensland. Now, the history that would normally be taught would have had nothing about North Queensland. That is, their part of Australia didn't really show up at all. And so I started by thinking, well, this isn't good enough. There's got to be something about North Queensland that they've got to learn about their own part of Australia. So I began to put in local history into the ordinary history course. I set aside 3 weeks to start with, which was entirely about local history. Now, out of that developed a lot of very detailed work by students of mine and other students in James Cook, as it became, on the history of North Australia, because that was what we could do, and we could do well. And many, many of these studies were published. They were theses, and then they became books. And as a result of both my work, but also the work of my students, I gradually came to see that really the history of the North should be treated as a single unit, rather than the extension of Western Australia, the extension of South Australia into the Territory, and the extension of Queensland up to Cape York. That it was normally, the North Australia was normally treated in this way, in a north-south way. But if you looked at it as a unity, that is tropical Australia right across the north, you could tell a quite different story.
And it was different because there was a multiculturalism that was quite separate to down south?
Well, all sorts of... I mean, one is that settlement began in the south, but it petered out in the north. So that at 1901, when Federation came, when the whole of Australia became, you know, part of the federal country, there were very, very few Europeans in North Australia. I mean, west of Charters Towers, there are only a few hundred Europeans all the way to Broome. There were also many, many Aborigines who had no contact with Europeans still. There were also the Aborigines provided almost the sole workforce for the pastoral industry, unlike the South. It was also much closer to Asia and Melanesia, so there was a very much more mixed population than existed in the South. And because there were few Europeans, Asians in places like Cairns and Darwin and Broome made up a very, very substantial part of the population, probably a majority in Darwin. And so it was a very different place. And this was a great threat to southern white Australia. And it was one of the main reasons for the White Australia policy.
Yeah, and this was new to me. I didn't realise that the White Australia policy was almost as much of a response to what was going on in the north of the country as it was to, you know, foreign lands, if you like.
Well, there's always this idea that we'd be swamped by the vast numbers living in nearby Asia. But it was in particular the fact that North Australia, as I say, from Mackay all the way around to Broome, was an operating multiracial society and, on the whole, a fairly successful one. And there's no doubt that the Chinese and the Japanese in particular were the driving entrepreneurial force in the North. And this was a situation which was abhorrent to people in the South. also abhorrent to the people in the South was the increasing mixed descent population that they were appalled about. And so white Australia was in many ways a reaction to what existed in the North. It was the white South declaring war on the multiracial North.